what happened with the Daily Beast and Newsweek. It seems like there were talks about a merger, and then it seemed like it fell apart, and then kind of came together again. How did it go exactly?
Well, as we reported yesterday, talks had never entirely broken down. There was sort of a very public interruption in the talks, where the Beast had put a statement that the engagement was fun, but the prenup got too complex. And so most of the media world sort of turned its attention away from the deal. They thought it was over. But Barry Diller, who owns the Daily Beast, and Sidney Harmon, who owns Newsweek, continued to meet and made a lot of progress this week. And last week, they were able to hammer out a deal. Last night, they were able to hammer out a deal.
And what was the sticking point before, and how did it get resolved?
It was what came out of the time. It was the governance structure. Just who was reporting to who. Between Diller and Harmon, who would be the 51% guy and who would be the 49% guy? They both obviously wanted to be the 51% guy. The arrangement they've worked out now is a 50-50 split, and so we actually don't know how they're going to resolve disagreements. There's talk of a board of some kind, but, those details we just don't know yet.
So in other words, neither of them gets kind of the final say. They're going to somehow have to do a power-sharing arrangement.
Exactly.
Huh. That's pretty interesting. It sounds like it might be hard to make that work with two strong personalities.
Well, three if you include Tina.
Yeah.
she's obviously, she's the star here, and sort of now both men, I think probably feel like they're her boss. And that, that to me sounds like a recipe for some fireworks.
For sure. And you were at Newsweek before. How do you feel about, how things have changed there and the prospects with Daily Beast?
You mean from the perspective of a former Newsweek staffer?
Yeah. I mean, as a former staffer and as someone who just understands the way things work
there,
and I guess, with something like this, there's always the cultural issue of, taking something that's a web first publication and then a print publication with, I think, two different mentalities and trying to meld that together. I would guess that would be one big issue.
Yeah. I think the Newsweek staff is pretty relieved just to have finality, some finality, any finality. They've been through a summer when it was sort of up in the air who was going to buy the magazine, and they went through a fall where it was unclear who was going to edit the magazine. And the range of things that could have happened to it are enormous. One of the bidders that the Washington Post company, the company that was selling Newsweek, one of the buyers that they were considering was the same people who owned the National Enquirer. They proposed merging back office staffs, to save on advertising, people, salaries, and HR costs, stuff like that. And on the other hand, you had Sidney Harmon, who was sort of this 92-year-old, philanthropist, retired businessman, had even worked as in government for a while, college professor. That range of buyers was huge. And then in terms of who's going to edit the thing, it was everything from maybe one of the current interim editors would get the job full-time, sort of like when a Major League Baseball team might can their manager and then have a minor league coach come up just, for the interim, and they end up getting the job. Or Tina Brown, who is a person who's going to come in with her extremely strongly held opinions, change everything about that place. She'll change the kinds of stories they do, the kind of writers they assign to different stories. She has great cover ideas. She affects who they can hire. She'll certainly get rid of some people. She's going to be a bull in a china shop. If there's any china left to break.
Good point. So it sounds like there'll be a lot of interesting things going on there. A lot of change. Basically, is the big
Very much so.
Bottom line. You've also covered Slate and done a pretty big article for The Observer about that.
Mm-hmm.
You hadn't had a disclosure on that article. I know there was some criticism of that. Do you feel like it was warranted, or do you feel like it wasn't necessary to have a disclosure?
Maybe. you know, it's a newspaper, and you know, there are deadlines that, you know, if we'd had if someone had raised that, then yeah, why not toss a disclosure on there? To my mind, you know, it would have, if I'd done that, it would have been you know, a very small one sentence thing, because the connection is sort of I'm always in favor of disclosing stuff, so sure, why not? But in this case, the connection is pretty. It doesn't really matter to me in terms of the reporting. I mean, I used to work for Newsweek, which is a division of the Washington Post Company, and I was writing about Slate, which is currently a division of the Washington Post Company. So, you know, I've never worked for Slate. I've never written for Slate. To me, there wasn't much, really wasn't much to worry about.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it depends how far you want to stretch disclosures, because so many companies are connected to so many others.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's true that, you know, I mean, I've rode the elevator many times with Jacob Weisberg, but I don't feel like that compromises my ability to interview him after I've gone to a new publication.
Yeah.
You know, everything I've written about Newsweek, there's a disclosure,
right?
You know, in everything.
Yeah. Do you feel like you want to get away from writing about things related to the Washington Post?
Yeah.
Don't get tagged as, like, I'm writing about all the places I used to work.
Yeah, you know, no, I mean, I got some congrats on breaking the story last night, but it's like, well, you know, save your, you know, from friends, and it was like, save your congratulations until I break some news that doesn't have to do with the Post Company.
Right. I mean, you know, Weisberg had this whole response, and there's, you know, media, it was like there's a new war going on. I mean, do you feel like it's a little bit overblown on this kind of fight back and forth?
There's absolutely no war of any kind. It was a single piece and then a follow-up from me. I was surprised that Weisberg, you know, said in his memo that went to Romanesco, that he sort of tried to dispute me on traffic and stuff, because I sort of thought I was doing the decent thing by only giving 1 month of traffic numbers in my piece, when I have their entire traffic information going back to January 2007.
Yeah.
So in my follow-up, I was happy to put up more numbers that sort of give the picture that Slate is doing good but not great online.
Right.
In terms of his traffic, I think that, as I said, you know, 8,000 or 9,000 times in the piece, their editorial output is terrific. But there's just a sense among staff that their competitors their competitors in the sense of, you know, people who put out stuff online that people are supposed to click on, are passing them by in terms of a whole range of technological stuff.
Yeah, and traffic doesn't seem to be that secretive of a thing. I mean, yeah, Omniture numbers, it's an internal thing, but, I mean, most sites will share that with advertisers, and I mean, you can get traffic from ComScore or Compete. I mean, there's so many places to get it. It doesn't seem like that, you know, proprietary of a thing.
Oh yeah, you know, because for example, you know, if you want to compare two sites, it's sort of better to use a third party, because the third party measures are all inaccurate, but at least they'll be inaccurate in the same way.
Right.
If you're looking at two or three different sites, so you can those are useful for relative fixtures, you know. You know, if Quantcast says that Gawker and Slate were at this level on, say, you know, the first of the year, well, where are they now?
Yeah.
I mean, as far as, you know, Slate is, its traffic is up, but, you know, most, it's page views. Uniques are down, but page views are up. The question is, you know, they're up, depending on what time frame you're measuring, somewhere in the order of, like, for last month it was 6%. Other months they've had better. It's been all the way up to 15%, I think. But Gawker's up, you know, 200%. And
yeah,
it's, you know, no one is comparing the, you know, the quality of the writing on Gawker with the quality of the writing on Slate, but that's not really the point.
Yeah.
There's a lot of concern among staffers. You know, the ones I quoted in the piece, former staffers, and then many that I didn't quote in the piece. It's, you know, there's widespread concern that they do great stuff, but that they're not as essential as they used to be. They're not kings of the web. Their people are not being poached away by the New York Times and the New Yorker, as they have done many times in the past. And there's just a sense that something is slipping away. And Weisberg, who was a terrific editor of the site, is sort of been a mixed success as an executive.
Yeah. Do you think he's got a point about how important page views really are versus revenues and, like, regular traffic? Because I know there's been a lot of talk about, you know, you look at Gawker and the way that they, mm-hmm. you know, pay people for page views mm-hmm. and things like that, and, you know, how advertisers are now looking at time spent and other metrics and the kind yeah. of people who are at site. So I wonder if there is a point around that, that, you know, maybe traffic numbers are not the be-all, end-all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. Time on site is very important, and Slate is good in that respect. And they have a lot of luxury advertisers. So, you know, they are in that they're going the right direction there, but they're still not profitable, as the current editor of the site, David Plotz, pointed out to me. Slate is not profitable. The Slate Group, which is the umbrella, is not profitable. And they're still at a low enough level where a couple of ad deals that come in or don't come in will really tilt the difference. They yeah. have had a break-even year a couple of years ago. Basically, in 2008, 2009, 2010, or in the last 2 years, they have not been profitable. And, you know, I just, I hope they do become profitable because I love Slate. I think it's fantastic. it's, you know, the number one comment I got from people after my piece ran was from people who were saying that they found that they love Slate, but they find that they can miss it for a few days now. They find that they can go a whole week, you know, if they have a busy week at work, they can just sort of skip it and then come back and not feel like they really missed anything. And, you know, Weisberg in the piece boasted to me that Slate basically invented blogging, which is its own, we can talk about that, whether how true that is. But, you know, he definitely didn't invent SEO, which is sort of Google tweaking, didn't invent aggregation, which is how a lot of sites get a lot of hits on their pages.
Right.
They're not doing verticals like Huffington Post, sort of doubling down on. They don't do social networking terribly well. You know, they have
right.
a relatively small number of Twitter followers. And so I think, you know, at the end of the day, what we might have is a site that, you know, churns out great stories, is well written, well edited, and roughly comes to like a break-even point, or maybe 1 year it loses $1 million, next year it makes $1 million, something around there, and that's fine. You know, that's great for them, and I'm glad they exist. But you know, there's just the sense that if you know, the Washington Post Company bought Slate from Microsoft to be its bridge to the future of publishing, and the reality is that this site is very tech backwards, and the guy who is the chairman of the umbrella company has had a mixed track record in making Slate sort of a publishing an online publishing empire.
I wonder if part of it is that, you know, online trying to be around for 15 years and you know, succeed and continue to be someone who's, you know, the online pioneer or something is very difficult. There's always going to be someone starting up the next year that's going to get all the heat. I mean, people mm-hmm. just don't have that loyalty online.
Yeah, you know, stopping reading Slate is a lot easier than sort of canceling a subscription to the New Yorker. You know,
right.
it keeps coming, and you know, they might have your credit card on file, so it just keeps coming in the mail. With Slate, you know, it's just not typing it in one day. It's not, you know, it's deleting its bookmark. You know, as more people turn to Twitter as their or Facebook as their news source, in the sense that they, you know, their friends post links and they read those links.
Yeah.
You know, what people read is broadening, and you've got, you know, the Daily Beast and Slate are not one-to-one competitors, but the Daily Beast has some stuff that on a given day people will read instead of reading Slate. And the same goes for Gawker. The same goes for The Atlantic. The same goes for Huffington Post. And you're seeing their audience sort of start to splinter off.
Yeah.